You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.
Atomic Insights.
Reading through the email that you forwarded, Bill Garland's an interesting guy. He's got quite a few interesting articles about history and technology of CANDU. I don't know if we've talked about the CANTEACH site before, but the CANTEACH site is the Canadian nuclear technology training website. And they provide that information to all the people who are coming into the system for the first time and actually spent a couple months actually reading over it a few years ago. And he's got a lot of neat and useful opinions. And this gets to the heart of some of my memories from undergrad, my experience of engineering education as it was practiced 10 years ago. So we could probably start from there, or how did you want to segue into it?
Well, we'll segue by introducing ourselves again and saying this is the Atomic Show, and it's show number 20. I'm Rod Adams, and I'm coming to you from Annapolis, Maryland, and it's today before Independence Day. 2006.
All right. And this is Shane Brown coming to you from Los Lunas, New Mexico. And like I started off way too quickly, we were talking about topics for today. And Rod had forwarded me an email exchange that he'd had with one of his regular readers. And this led into a conversation before we started recording about the state of engineering education. In, at least in the United States and possibly also in Canada, and how it's affecting the types of people who are getting attracted into engineering and their ability to actually do practical engineering as opposed to wander off into an R&D think tank and spend the rest of their days there doing paper reports.
Well, you know, it's interesting that email string that I sent to you includes an awful lot of thoughts that are kind of distilled into very short paragraphs. But what it brings to me is a little bit of an explanation as to why I'm not an engineer and why I didn't study engineering in college. Although I have played an engineer in the U.S. Navy for a few years and was an operating engineer for a number of years. And am thought to be a technical geek at my current job. When I went to college, I had every intention of majoring in engineering. And when I went and talked to the professors in the engineering departments at my alma mater, the Naval Academy, at the time, what I thought was that they didn't seem to have much respect and faith in human beings. They didn't have much time in their curricula for humanities, and they certainly didn't seem to think that studying things like history and foreign languages and that kind of stuff should be part of a what they considered to be a strong undergraduate engineering education. So after talking with those guys, I went over and found some people that had a different view of life and decided to major in English.
That reminds me of an awful lot of what I went through about 10 years ago now. In spring of 1996, I was finishing up spending 2 years at a community college in South Mississippi, and I had majored in that college as basically Jack of all trades, master of none, was the AA undecided course, which was, okay, we're going to throw a whole bunch of stuff at you, and whichever you decide you like, we'll just focus on that, whatever college you go on to. And I'd gotten to the spring semester of my fourth semester there, and I had gone through some fairly high-level English lit classes and composition classes, and had a grand old time talking over the classics and spending an awful lot of time talking with teachers and students about how this stuff is relevant to living today. And then I had to make a choice, I had to make a choice in that spring semester whether I wanted to go into something more humanities-oriented or more engineering-oriented. And I kind of tried to have it both ways that last semester. I chose not to do a course in engineering statics, which is basically some force is equal to zero to figure out why a bridge is held up, and decided to take a course in lit, in English lit, that last semester. And then later that year, I ended up going to Mississippi State and started in aero, and then got my butt handed to me on a plate because I had been kind of coasting along without really having to work for it and reap the rewards from that for a semester, and then got my butt in gear for the next few years and finally got my degree. But I think I went through something of the same kind of dilemma about what to do.
Well, part of the problem seems to be that because of the number of courses that the association, let's see, ABET, Association
yep.
for the, tell me what that stands for.
We went through an ABET certification at Mississippi State in 1999, but and I actually got to meet a few of the accreditors, but I cannot honestly remember offhand what it stands for. But
you can look it up, and while you're looking it up, what I will continue on by saying is there's a tremendous number of courses that are specifically required in order to get an accredited engineering degree, and those courses tend to focus on physics and materials and statics and dynamics and important courses. I'm not trying to short those at all, but what it does is it tends to bring undergraduate engineers to the point where they really don't have much time for design. They don't have much time for economic calculations, and they certainly don't have much time for some of the electives in humanities that could let them understand a little bit more about the people that will have to operate whatever it is that they
yeah.
engineer.
By the way, I have an answer for you on ABET. ABET stands for the Accreditation Board for Engineering and Technology. And this is the group of industry consultants and such who go from college to college and make, in the United States at least, and make sure that those colleges and universities' engineering programs meet the standards that they have set for what you have to have in your curriculum in order to turn out actual engineering graduates. That was my understanding of it 7 years ago, and I don't know that it's changed very much since then.
Yes, and so anyway, my decision was to go towards a degree that allowed me the time to take those courses. Now, I probably would not have made that decision in any other college in the United States because, as it happened, my English degree also required me to take 4 semesters of calculus, base mathematics, a semester of differential equations, 2 semesters of calculus-based physics, a year's worth of electrical engineering, a year's worth of physics, what else? A whole bunch of other stuff. So I only
that's exactly the same undergrad curriculum that I had without being in an English degree.
Well, you know, the Naval Academy at one time awarded nothing but engineering degrees, and the majors program was something that was brought in during the Vietnam era to try to attract a few additional folks at the time they were having trouble. And anyway, it turned out to be the right thing for me because I really enjoyed the writing and the reading and learning more about people and history. And I think that over time, that humanities background has stood me in very good stead, even as I tried to focus most of my professional life in being a technologist and understanding the effects that technology has on people and the benefits that technology provides to people. One of the things that really kind of gets my goat is trying to explain to creative folks, artists and authors and those kinds of folks, just why it is that I find that engineering is a very creative activity. And after a while, they seem to get it. But the general feel in most colleges and universities is that there's the liberal arts folks and there's the engineers and scientists, and never the twain shall meet.
That goes back to C.P. Snow and the tale of two cultures that he, paraphrasing the title, but is that C.P. Snow was a professor at an English university who had observed this phenomenon back in the 50s, and it's only gotten deeper and deeper since then, to the point where a lot of my friends, one of my friends actually, he started off in engineering, but he ended up choosing to go into an English major program and then went on for his master's. He chose to get out because he went over to the research facility where I was working later, across the road, Engineering Research Center in Mississippi State, and said, "Hey, I'm here, I'm in engineering, and I'm excited about it, and what can I do?" And they said, "Okay, can you program?" And he said, "Sure, I can program in Pascal." And he said, "Okay, here you go," and gave him a 4,000-line Fortran program to modify into doing something that he had absolutely no idea how to do. He had no guidance, and basically he was struck by just how uncaring and unmentoring an attitude they had over there is. They just basically said, "Sink or swim."
So you majored in engineering, aerospace engineering, but you ended up going into being a computer programmer. How did that happen?
It's interesting because I, up until maybe 10 years ago, was not a very good programmer. I had exposure when I was in grade school to BASIC, and this was in the 80s, and then that kind of bounced off, and then I took a course in Pascal my senior year of high school, and that bounced off my thick skull too. And it wasn't until I finally had an exposure to Fortran and got to see a teeny tiny little program, maybe 20 or 30 lines. If you code it right, it can do an extremely large amount of work. And at the same time, somebody had brought to my attention a quote from the old IBM adage that computers should work and people should think. And it's at that point that I really started getting interested in programming, and not programming it for its own sake, but programming for computer modeling, where we have to take practical problems and break them down into chunks that a computer can understand and work on, and then return results that A, make sense, B, are in the ballpark, and C, are usable by engineers. And I think Don Knuth said once that the only thing that we can explain to a computer is things that involve mathematics. Art is everything else. So I got into computer programming because I was interested in the kinds of numerical modeling, what some of the stuff that uses that stuff like finite element analysis and computational fluid dynamics. That was really what got me into programming.
Yeah, I've spent some time doing programming myself, and when I was in graduate school, I had a ball doing some computer graphics and some real high fidelity three-dimensional modeling back in the mid-1980s using Silicon Graphics machines, and I really liked it. I liked it so much that I decided that I needed to stop doing it, otherwise I was going to become seriously addicted and unable to talk to people anymore.
Is the joke that friend of mine who decided to pull the ripcord and get out of engineering was, "You people over at the Engineering Research Center are just totally unable to have fun." "What do you mean?" "Well, I go over there and I see people sleeping on their desks. I see people going for days and days and weeks without bathing, without human contact, and pretty much when you ask them fun, the only thing that they say is program, fun, program.
So back to some nuclear business. Looks like the Japanese are coming to the U.S. in a big way. Over the last couple of months, there's been some real activity in, well, Toshiba, of course, purchased Westinghouse, which is one of the largest concentrations of nuclear expertise in the U.S. And since that time, there was an announcement about 2 weeks ago that General Electric is partnering with Hitachi, who they've partnered with in some Eastern nuclear power projects before, some Asian nuclear power projects, and they're going to be building two more boiling water reactors, and I think that they're going to be doing the advanced boiling water reactor, ABWR, for Texas Industries, Texas Utilities, TXU.
They say where the site is?
Yeah, it's going to go on the South Texas project. Let's see, I can't pull that up right now, but I'll give it a second here.
I mean, as I recall, there was one of the very last of the first generation of nuclear plants to came online in Texas. It was a facility that finally came online in 91 or 1992.
Yep, and I believe that this project will be going on the same site because the company, TXU, when they initially cited that South Texas project, it was large enough to, actually it's NRG Energy. NRG Energy is a part owner of the South Texas project and located in Matagorda County, Texas.
That's way far south Texas. It's like getting close to Brownsville.
Right now that site has two boiling water reactors on it. And they have opted to order the ABWR, the Advanced Boiling Water Reactor, which has already received a design certification from the NRC. It's interesting because General Electric's not really pushing that reactor. The reactor they're trying to sell is the ESBWR for the Evolutionary Simplified Boiling Water Reactor. And they're going to go through the certification process for that reactor sometime starting either late next year or early 2008, I believe.
So is the ABWR project that they're looking for the South Texas project, is that going to be put in the same sizes that they put the last two that were built, which were in Japan?
About
1,400 megawatts piece.
Yeah, 1,350 megawatts is the information that I received. Total of 2,700 megawatt addition to their generating fleet. Now, I think this is great news. Of course, the bad news part of this announcement by NRG Energy, which I blogged about a week or so ago, was that the total project investment that NRG wants to do is about 10,500 megawatts, so roughly 25% of the addition is nuclear, and the rest is going to be natural gas and coal. And kind of interesting, the company has a real strong desire to continue doing things that it already knows how to do and keep the risk down. So each of the additions that they're talking about are going to be similar to plants that already exist on the sites that they're planning to build.
So they're not going to be they're just going to be adding to existing plants. They're not going to be turning any soil for new plant sites.
It doesn't look like it. It looks like places where they have a, say, an integral combined cycle gas turbine, IGCC, or an integrated gasification combined cycle is what it is, IGCC, they're going to build another one like that. If they've got a circulating pulverized coal power plant, they're going to build another one like that on that site. And then down where they have the boiling water reactors, they're going to add two more of those. Makes sense, though.
Three-quarters of the project expansion that they're looking at doing with non-nuclear, what proportion of that is natural gas? Is most of it going to be natural gas or coal, or is it even split?
No, it's most, I think it's about, of let's see, 8,000 megawatts at non-nuclear, something like 5,000 or 6,000 is coal. And the other parts of the natural gas portion is almost all peakers. So they're not intended to run all the time. They're intended to be cycling plants that provide power only when necessary.
Right.
But they still you know, count as capacity.
On the one hand, it's good that they're introducing a project that has such a large quote unquote nuclear component to it, but it also seems like a failure of imagination that these people are doing this and they've not made it a much larger proportion of the project to be putting in nuclear facilities.
Well,
given how the costs of not just natural gas, but of coal have gone up. I mean, coal, the cost of fuel has gone up, 60%?
Yeah, the cost
in the last year.
Well, the cost of coal is actually doubled in the last 2 years. So it's significantly more expensive. And the other part about coal that is a challenge that some people have trouble understanding is it's not so much how much coal there is ultimately at the mines, it's the how much coal at what rate can be delivered to the power plants in the places where the power plants need to be located, because the transmission of coal is through rail lines, and expanding rail lines is problematic in many cases.
Not to mention that a lot of the coal, new coal mining capacity that's being brought online is coming from a lot of the western central Wyoming, Montana portion of the United States, and then you have to transport that coal 2,000 miles over rail. Very thin, very long straw to be transporting thousands upon thousands of tons of material per day per plant.
Yeah,
not to mention, what are they going to do with the ash?
Yeah, exactly. The ash has to be handled in some manner. And Western coal tends to have a bit lower heat content than does Eastern coal.
Which means you have to burn more of it.
Right.
To get the same.
It has less sulfur, but it has less heat content also. So there's a lot more ash content, unburnable stuff in it.
Right.
You can roughly say that it takes about 10,000 to 14,000 tons of coal per day to feed a 1,000 megawatt power plant, depending on the heat content of the coal. So. That's a lot of material to move from one place to another.
That's between 50 and 100,000 tons of additional coal per day that are going to be heading into South Texas.
Yep.
Just order of magnitude.
Of course, when I talked about NRG Energy adding 10,000 megawatts, it's not all in Texas. They have other places where they produce power. I could go through and find the press release and find out where those are, but... you know, the other alternative that some folks propose for, you know, coal-fired power is they say, well, you don't need to necessarily move the coal. You can just move the electricity. And in order to do that, you have to build large power plants at the coal mines and then build the transmission lines from the coal coal-fired power plants to the loads, building transmission lines is also problematic, particularly when you have to cross, you know, mountain ranges and national forests and national parks and reserve areas, and then through towns and everything else. It's yep. It's pretty expensive.
And then maintain them and deal with the fact that storms bring them down.
Oh yeah, you know, ice storms that collapse the lines or something like that.
There was a company that I knew of in North Alabama that I think I actually almost interviewed with, and I got another job offer before they could respond. But they had a business of using GPS equipped general aviation planes, like little Cessnas, to fly along transmission line rights of way and basically do a variety of jobs for the companies that were responsible for maintaining those lines. And they had money rolling in hand over fist because of how much line had to be inspected and doing it aerially and doing all the jobs that they needed to do aerially had an awful lot of advantage. Not to mention the fact that especially the really high tension stuff, the stuff that's up around 500 to 700,000 kilovolt, there's a process that linemen use where they actually get onto the lines from a helicopter, so they don't even go out there in trucks anymore. They just fly from point to point on the helicopter, and the helicopter bonds onto the line, and the process is kind of spectacular to watch.
Yeah, one of the things that's always interesting about those transmission lines is they don't have any insulation on them. They're, you know, the insulation is the air between the lines.
Yeah. So and, long as you follow the 11-foot tube rule.
Yep, and a lineman can touch one of the lines with no problem.
Just as long as no part of his body is touching something connected to the ground.
Right, or as long as he doesn't touch another line because the lines
right.
are...
Line-to-line voltage.
Right, carrying different phases. Yeah, Dad was a transmission substation engineer, so I learned all about moving coal by wire because... Living in South Florida with, you know, people that cared about how the air looked and, you know, inviting tourists down and all that stuff, the Florida Public Utility Commission didn't want Florida Power and Light to locate any coal plants down in South Florida. So after the company decided that building nuclear plants was too risky because of the delays that were imposed on them and some of the other problems that they had with the nuclear plants, mainly the Public Utility Commission telling them they couldn't recover their costs, they decided to build coal plants and locate them in northeast Georgia. And so Florida Power and Light then built 500 million kilovolt amp lines, 500 kVA, yeah, 500 kilovolt amp lines. All the
Those
way
are
from,
the lines that look like the actual power lines are four conductors held in a square cross section, and there are three of those squares going across horizontally, and they're held by two insulators that look like a V. So you have three Vs holding the lines.
Right, and they're very large swath of land. It's going alongside the Florida Turnpike. There's probably more land devoted to the transmission towers than there is to the turnpike itself.
Yep.
It's pretty impressive. But
an awful lot of engineering to keep those nasty coal plants far away where there are no tourists to complain about them.
Well, speaking of engineering and transmission lines, going back to that email exchange I had with Bill Garland, the impetus for that was a proposed DC power distribution network. Somebody has called the super grid, and what they want to do is build super cooled DC transmission lines that are cooled down by liquid nitrogen to reduce transmission losses. And they think the people that are proposing this think that will allow you to put, you know, very large nuclear power parks off in remote areas, or, you know, large coal-fired facilities off in remote areas away from people, and then transmit the power wherever you want to go. And they think that that would be the more, you know, logical way to go as we move forward. But, I mean, my response to that is that, you know, it seems so complicated to build all of your facilities in one place far away from where the customers are, and then figure out all these very difficult ways of burying cable and putting refrigerated liquid nitrogen next to the cable. And I mean, I look at that and I just say, man, that is the type of thing that caused me not to want to be an engineer, because only an engineer could love such a system.
Yep. There was a quote from one of the better literary voices from the aeronautical engineering tradition. His name was Antoine de Saint-Exupéry. He wrote quite a few books for kids. Among them was The Little Prince, and he was also an expert aviator and aeronautical engineer in France in the 20s. And he had a saying that perfection is achieved not when nothing more is added, but when there's nothing left to take away.
That's exactly the design philosophy that I like to adhere to whenever possible. And one of the reasons why I've always been a far larger fan of Steve Jobs as opposed to Bill Gates. One of the things that you have to be able to do in order to design elegant systems is you have to be willing at some point to throw away what you've done before and start with a clean slate and get rid of the appendages that cause you to make some very strange choices in new designs if you try to keep all of the appendages that you've had before.
Using superconductors, especially liquid nitrogen temperature superconductors, that's just a thorn's nest of nightmarish problems, because the superconductors they're talking about are not metals. Those are ceramic superconductors. So basically they're talking about tongue and grooving pieces of ceramic one into the other, foot by foot, and basically welding them together. And the process of making that work and dealing with thermal issues and liquid nitrogen transport, and it'd be a hell of a lot of fun to model from my point of view as a computational guy, but then the practical side kicks in. Who's going to pay for this, and why are we paying for it?
Right. How does that make things better for the customer? I mean, the goal of an electric distribution system is to get electricity to the customer. Yeah. And the funny thing is people forget just how many times we are using electricity in places where we are not connected to any grid. For example, every time I drive my car, I have air conditioning, I have a radio, I have other accoutrements that are powered by electricity, but I'm not connected to any grid when I'm in my car. Take a larger example. When I used to go to sea on submarines, I would take 150 of my favorite people, seal ourselves up in a 9,000-ton ship, and drive all over the ocean doing things like eating, sleeping, having the air conditioning, making our own air, making our own water, playing stereos, watching movies, all the things that people do with electricity, yet we're never connected to any grid while we're out there either.
By the way, how much hydrogen did you have to vent in order to provide enough air for 150 guys? Assuming you were electrolyzing it.
Sure. We were, you know, taking H2O and breaking it into H2 and O2 and venting the hydrogen over the side. We made, I can't remember the number anymore. It's been 15 years since I was at sea on a submarine. So it wasn't a tremendous amount of hydrogen.
No.
Bubbled
I would imagine not, since water is 88% by weight oxygen, so there's not very much hydrogen to go over the side, except if you count it by volume.
Right. So, it wasn't a huge issue, although I do, smile when I tell people that I, have run hydrogen generators for years. We just called them oxygen generators and threw away the hydrogen, but they obviously made pure hydrogen as well.
Right. Best thing to do of it is dump it overboard with the bilge. Now, there's a thought for the hydrogen economy people.
Yeah. So the point that I was trying to make is that, we know how to generate electricity without having large central station power plants. We know how to get it to people. The reason that we went towards a system with centralized generation and then distribution of the electricity over long wires is an interesting thing to think about from a historical point of view. But the reality is that we started to do it because we wanted to use the power that was represented by large volumes of falling water in Niagara Falls, New York, and the place where the customers were for that electricity happened to be a few hundred miles south in New York City. And so we figured out that in order to move that power from Niagara Falls down to New York City, we had to build long transmission lines and had to figure out a way to transmit that power efficiently, and thus Westinghouse's alternating current seemed to be the best choice for that kind of thing. That same centralized distribution model seemed to work very well for coal-fired power stations or large oil-fired power stations because it was a lot simpler to deliver those fuels to a single place via large ships or trains than it was to move that fuel into ever smaller containers to get it to people or to smaller generators spread around the place.
But the equation changes abruptly when you can carry the energy equivalent of a super tanker of oil 3 football fields long in a backpack.
Exactly my point. Once you have the ability to generate electricity using a fuel that is so compact that a person can hold the equivalent of 30 tanker trucks full of oil in the palm of his hand, or like you say, a single person can carry a super tanker's worth of fuel in a backpack, the equation's different. Of course, the other part of that equation is that reactors, when they are operating, do not release anything but heat and electricity. They don't need smokestacks. And one of the other reasons why the central station power plant model worked well was it allowed us to move the burning of the dirty fuel out of the cities and into the countryside where the solution to pollution is dilution.
That's a seriously social thing to do.
Well,
talking about taking it outside.
What do you mean by social thing to do?
In terms of being a good neighbor. Oh, we'll just take the stuff out back and dump it someplace where people don't care. Well, what about the people out who happen to live out there? Nah, there's not enough of them to matter. That seems to be the unspoken assumption.
Well, absolutely. It is the unspoken assumption that places that are sparsely populated are the places to locate large polluting facilities. And to a certain extent, it makes some sense that, if you've got a place like London, England, where, because of the local way that gases hang and stuff, or Los Angeles, you're subject to very serious air pollution problems, it makes sense to get the smokestacks out of the city. However, it does not really change anything when you think about global effects, and it certainly doesn't change anything when you think about some of the downwind effects in places like upstate New York, which happens to be the recipient of all the Midwest coal-burning power plant emissions.
Yep.
As a gift of the jet stream.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of I had a discussion with a guy from California not too long ago, and he was making an interesting point. You know, California has this reputation of being the place where, you know, everybody's conservation has worked, and, you know, the green movement has really done its job and all that stuff. But he said, you know, the reality is that, you know, California happens to import its electricity from its neighbors, but its neighbors are downwind of it. Wyoming and Nevada, which burn coal for California and transmit the power into California, are downwind already. So they don't, California doesn't have to receive the pollution from those states. You know, that goes somewhere to the east.
Out of sight, out of mind.
But California's starting to notice an increase in pollution from its own, from the areas to the west of it.
China.
Notably all the way from China. The coal that's being burned in China to supply manufactured products to the United States is becoming a source of pollution for California. You know, that just the air moves around the globe in a relatively predictable fashion. So, anyway, one of the things that California is doing right now is there's an awful lot of effort being made to build coal-fired power stations in Wyoming to feed California's need for electricity, since California still has a rule in place that they can't develop any new nuclear plants until a permanent solution to nuclear byproduct disposal is agreed upon. I tried to phrase that very carefully because I don't think there's any real problem with how to store the byproducts of nuclear operations, and I certainly don't think that the byproduct should ever be buried in the ground.
But not to mention the fact that even if they did, the safety of doing that has already been demonstrated for us by nature at the Oklo reactor.
Absolutely. Yeah,
byproducts that were produced by the Oklo reactor running over the period of time that it did never migrated more than a foot in any direction from the layers where the reaction took place. And they were all of the thermal fission reactor products were there, strontium, cesium, all of them. We can see all of their daughter products sitting there to the present day, all stable, didn't move very far. It's because they're not, by and large, the vast majority of them are not terribly volatile.
Nope.
And what few that there are that are volatile have very short half-lives.
And they're not terribly mobile. You know, none of these materials, you know, have legs to get up and walk away.
Right. As soon as krypton 85, which is one of the fission products, turns into another material, it becomes a solid. So all you have to do is wait around for the gas to turn into a solid. What other industry can get away with doing that?
Yep. Well, the fact of the matter is, you can just store the stuff and.
Yeah,
and
we can store it arbitrarily long and in arbitrarily large quantities compared to what fossil fuel people have to do.
Right.
Because the quantities that we're dealing with are millions of times smaller.
Yep. Well, there's been some other interesting developments that may have an impact for Adams Atomic Engines. There's a serious effort to reduce the air pollution that's coming from the port of Long Beach in Los Angeles, and some significant restrictions on the operation of diesel engines in the port. So I wonder if down the road the additional costs that that imposes on diesel operations will help us in our efforts to persuade the commercial shipping industry that it's time to take another look at an alternative to their oil addiction.
Based on what I saw when I was in Port of Long Beach about a year ago when I went out to Catalina Island, there's certainly a bit of a problem with a very large number of diesel-powered vehicles in a relatively small space. And I would certainly like to have seen some fraction of those vehicles not be dumping stuff over the sides in their bilges and their tailpipes.
I think that you and I had an exchange at one point. I kept meaning to, I still have it to post. I just never got around to it yet. On the other pollution that comes from a diesel-powered ship is not just coming out of the stack, but
because it's transported species, aliens.
It transports aliens from place to place. It's a little bit hard to explain, folks, but you know, when you're burning enough fuel to cross the ocean, you make a significant change in the buoyancy calculations for the ship, and unless you make some corrections for that, you can make the ship unstable. So what most
potentially capsize.
Yeah, what most very large ships have to do is, as they're burning their fuel to cross the ocean, they suck in water to displace that fuel to keep the ship as stable as it was when it started. Well, that means that the ship ends up moving water from place to place, and once it goes to its new port where it has to refuel, all of that foreign water with all of the stuff and whatever that grows in the foreign water has to be dumped out. And that is the source of an awful lot of invasive species that have come into ports all over the world.
Yeah.
You know, what's natural in one place is an invasive species in another.
It is actually crowding out species and causing all kinds of damage. Like, for instance, in the St. Lawrence Seaway in the Great Lakes system, a species called the zebra mussel was introduced from Asia by a container ship that had come over about 20 or 30 years ago. And prior to then, when people went diving in the St. Lawrence, it was a joke that, well, if you go diving here, you're not going to see very much until you get face-to-face with it, like a foot away. And now the St. Lawrence has become a diver's mecca because the visibility from all of these billions and billions of zebra mussels in the water, filtering the water, have caused the water to clarify to the point where you have 40 and 50 and 60 foot visibility, which is almost Caribbean level visibility.
Wow.
The trouble is that all those zebra mussels are now carpeting the very archaeological artifacts the divers are down there to look at, all the shipwrecks. It's literally breaking the shipwrecks down much faster than they would have had they remained in the mud.
Oh, well. Sometimes the second and third order systems analysis is hard to do. Well, Shane, I think it's about time to call it a day. I want to wish you and everyone else in the U.S. particularly a happy Independence Day. And I hope that one thing that people think about as they go about their day tomorrow is some way to be able to declare our independence from our addiction to burning fossil fuels. And if you really think about it, and you really do the math and the analysis, I have only found one source so far that can actually replace coal, oil, and gas, and that's nuclear fission. All of the other sources can take some of the burden, but they cannot replace one for one an oil, coal, or gas burning power plant.
Not if we want to get to the point where we're consuming 10 times or 20 times or 100 times the electrical power that we are now. That's my goal. I would love to see the world, the entire planet, come up to and exceed an American standard of living. And the way to do that is provide as much power as they want to run their industries and live their lives the way we get to.
Yeah, now, of course, that brings up before I say goodbye, somehow I would like to have the opportunity someday to have a couple of folks who care very much about the health and economic development of underprivileged people, and who've demonstrated their care by endowing a very, very large foundation called the William and Melinda Gates Foundation, and talked to them about the importance of electricity in terms of enabling education and health for people in those situations. I can't think of a single thing that could add more to their ability to develop than providing electricity.
Warren Buffett might be a good person to bring in on that conversation as well, based on the announcement he made week before last.
I agree with that, and he was the other person I was thinking of, but since he's given his money to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, now I know where the filter is.
All right.
But anyway, hey, you have a good weekend, well, the rest, whatever's left of your weekend. And
all right. Likewise.
Take care.
All right. Bye-bye.
You think show business is about entertainment, but you're wrong. It's about so many other things, like strategy and money and... Okay, just two other things. I'm Daniel Kay, and I'll be your guide through the mysterious labyrinth of the movies, television, and music on Box Office Weekly here on the Podcast Network. I know something about what motivates these people. Stop watching movies in the dark. Join me every week. Subscribe at boxofficethepodcastnetwork.com.
You're listening to the Podcast Network. Listen, learn, evolve.